Hello and welcome to Swiss Info's program for December 7th. I'm Susan Masika in Bern, where the winter session of Parliament is currently underway. A slip of the tongue helped loosen up the atmosphere of a sober parliamentary session on December 3rd. Senator Werner Lugenbühl was talking about the Nagoya Protocol on access to genetic resources when he misspoke.
What are pathological organisms? There are several definitions, like objects that make a certain orgasm sick.
Oops. Less humorous, but more importantly, Switzerland has its new president for 2014. On December 4th, Parliament accepted the nomination of Foreign Minister Didier Burkhalter. The 53-year-old is a centre-right radical from Canton-Neuchâtel. He received 183 of the 222 votes cast by the parliamentarians. Every calendar year, a different member of the seven-person cabinet takes over the Swiss presidency. The choice is based on seniority in the government, which means that a minister can be president at least once every 7 years. Swiss Info's Veronica DeVore was at Parliament on the day. She joined me in the studio earlier to tell me how it was.
Well, I have to say it was a little bit anticlimactic, and I almost missed it, as did many people in the hall. What takes place is that there's a joint session of the House and the Senate, and so there are theoretically, anyway, many more people in the House of Representatives chamber than there normally are. And that also means they can't use their electronic voting system in this particular vote.
They probably can't even sit down, huh?
I sort of expected that, but as it turned out, everyone was seated and it even looked emptier than I expected. But in any case, there are stewards who then collect paper ballots, in fact, from all of the voting members. And that happens about 8 a.m. And then about 15, 20 minutes later, as soon as they've got all the votes counted, a bell rings, and then there's a very fast announcement.
They're efficient, huh?
They're quite efficient, and in the interim, everyone's just milling about. There's no sort of waiting or silence. It's very casual, and then there's this announcement that Didier Burkhalter has been elected president of the Confederation for 2014. There's a cheer, and that's really the end of it.
So the people were happy. You got the impression overall.
I did get the impression, and in fact, the votes showed that. He had a quite good vote result. He got more votes than, I believe, any other elected president in the past decade.
But it wasn't out of the maximum, as you were saying.
Exactly. I spoke with Luzi Stamm, who's a parliamentarian from the Swiss People's Party. He was present at the vote, but he said several of his colleagues were not, which was perhaps the reason why Burkhalter did not achieve 200 votes, which would have been a very excellent result, and maybe what he was even hoping for. According to Stamm. And he said that some 44 members were not there, either because they missed a train or had some issues getting there or what have you, mostly due to the early hour.
And any other impressions that you got while you were there?
Well, I was expecting, you know, some celebration after the business had taken place, perhaps even, you know,
I mean, it's a bit early for champagne, but...
Sure. But maybe that being the end of business for the morning or something. But in fact, there's just a small refreshment table set up downstairs in the Parliament building. There were some nice little cakes and things from Canton Neuchâtel, where Burkhalter is from, representing his home, Canton. And there were also several delegates and friends from his home, Canton, present. So I heard a lot of French.
Oh, okay.
But Burkhalter himself actually was not at the refreshment table at the beginning, and it was somewhat quiet down there. The other parliamentarians joined if they could, but were really going about business as votes continued.
And really? So there was not a break at all, really?
Not really a break. You just sort of, you know, took a moment to congratulate the delegates, and then later Burkhalter himself did show up. I almost ran into him and his family as I was rushing off to an interview. There was quite a press pool around him, and it was treated as a somewhat, you know, grand entrance to the building after his election, but he was not present at the vote. And I presume then well into the refreshments, he perhaps went down and spoke to his well-wishers and said hello. But really, not much in the way of ceremony or pomp and circumstance, just a little nice recognition of what had taken place.
Burkhalter will take over from Defense Minister Uli Maurer on January 1st. Here at Swiss Info, we often have stories that we could tell about our work. I asked some of my other colleagues about memorable things that had happened to them while out in the field. Simon Bradley told me about his pursuit of the so-called jet man.
My story dates back to 2008 when I went on my first foreign reportage as a working for a Swiss media, Swiss Info, going back to Britain. And this was covering a flight by Yves Jetman Rossi, who is a Swiss daredevil, let's put it like that, who's a 54-year-old former commercial airline pilot, former fighter pilot, who basically has built a homemade jet-powered wing. And his plan was to fly across the English Channel with this jet-powered wing on his back from Calais in northern France to Dover. And he'd already done a number of flights in Switzerland. Basically, he was jumping out of a helicopter above Calais. I went across to Dover, and we were there. And unfortunately, for the first, we were waiting for him at this beautiful sort of cliffside location near Dover. And there were quite a number of British journalists and international journalists waiting. This was likely to be quite spectacular. But the weather was unfortunately, the weather changed quite quickly. And so the event got postponed for a couple of days. So there we were waiting and, you know, going. And by that time, most of the British press had got wind of the fact that this event was going to be taking place at that time.
And sort of superhero type coming across the channel by air.
Exactly. A Swiss Superman flying across the channel with a jet-powered wing. So you can imagine. They were straight on the story, and it was a quiet news time I can remember.
What season was it?
It was September.
Okay.
And so there we were, and it was postponed a couple of days. So by the third day, there were huge numbers of British press waiting, and I'd been looking forward to an exclusive interview with this Swiss pilot. So there were just hundreds of journalists, and the day he jumped, it was just perfect. 13 minutes, he flew across the channel, and it was quite strange. There was this tiny little speck in the air, and then everyone's saying, oh, there he is. And then the cameras are following him down. Bird is a plane, following him down, tiny speck. And then this kind of parachute, he flew round. He's obviously enjoying himself. And then he landed in a not where he was supposed to, right in front of us, but in a muddy field directly behind. And cue the Keystone Cops scene where the police, followed by 100 journalists, myself included, running across the muddy field to try and get his first impressions. It was very memorable. That's by my first foreign reportage for Swiss Info.
For video journalist Raffaella Rossello, collecting comments in foreign languages is always an interesting experience.
And the other person first gives you a short version of their answer in a language you understand. But then you ask them, could you please, if the person's Chinese, could you please tell me this in Chinese? Because we have a Chinese department, we could really use that. And so they go on and then they answer again in Chinese. And I look at them and I'm pretending like, oh, this is really good, you know, trying to keep my eyes focused on camera and them speaking and then listening to the flow. And I don't understand anything.
So you feel like a bit of a poser, huh? You're sort of faking this understanding.
Absolutely. And then I'm just hoping that when I bring my stuff back, my colleagues from the Chinese department will be able to use it. And I won't have, you know, something that starts too abruptly or ends too abruptly or makes sense, it flows. Sometimes I have to ask people to redo a take for technical reasons or just because it was too windy and too long. And
But how do you know if you don't know what they're saying?
Well, I just know it's too long. Or from the expression of their face, you know, like I just interviewed in the summer, for example, a professor, Japanese professor, a teacher, Jungian therapist, so very learned and skilled, and he wanted to give me a really precise answer to my question, which was very broad. And I could see from the expression of his eyes, you know, as we kept going, like more and more takes, that he was gaining confidence. So I just have to smile. smile and say, "Oh, this is very good." But maybe, you know, like you were staring at the camera, you're staring at the eye, at the camera's eye, and I need you to look at me. So could you please do this again? But yeah, that was very good. Thumbs up, you know, really good. And I could feel that he was getting more confident. And then at the end, he really thanked me. He said, "Oh, you helped me so much." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I didn't understand anything you said, but it sounded really good this time."
Well, it must make such a difference when they get somebody who's patient because, yeah, they could end up with a video journalist who just wants to get it over with and is giving them a dirty look because they don't seem to be able to say what they want to say. So
Yeah, absolutely.
Well done.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, it's an interesting thing to watch. Also, the communication that goes beyond the language, you know, the language barrier is there, but you can still pick things, you know, from the music, from the rhythm, from the facial expression, body expression, and it translates.
Sometimes getting there and back is almost more of a story than the story itself, as Thomas Stevens knows.
A couple of months ago, I went on a reportage to a really ugly suburb of Bern. I'm not going to name it in case I get beaten up.
Don't offend any of our listeners.
I mean, it's just warehouses and office complexes.
Maybe that's just all you saw.
My reportage was there. 5 minutes away on the train. The ticket costs 5 francs. And it's one of these tickets that you have to stamp before you get on the train. Do you know what I mean? You have to
machines on the
punch
platform,
it. Yeah,
right?
You have to put it in the machine. And going there, it's fine. I punched it. And I very rarely do this because normally I either bicycle or get a long distance train ticket. I got there. I did a great reportage about employing people with autism.
I remember that.
Read it on swissinfo.ch. Then I came back. I got to the station, you know, 10 minutes ahead of time. But I, for whatever reason, whether I was dreaming or tired or probably actually still thinking about my reportage and how I was going to write it, I completely forgot to stamp my return ticket. And I got on the train and immediately the conductor came along and said, "Where's your ticket?" And I thought, oh, immediately knew that I should have stamped it.
Because they can't be strict. I mean, they do check. They're often plain clothes.
They can be strict, and they were strict. I said, "Look, I'm really sorry. I just completely forgot." I had both of my tickets, my outgoing and
outbound.
Outbound and my return. And I said, "I was a journalist, you know, I'm just
going
back
now.
To Bern, you know," and everything was there. And I showed him my recording material.
Wow.
And he said,
wasn't impressed.
No, he wasn't at all. He said, "Yeah, but you've got to stamp it." And he was right. Obviously, I didn't have a leg to stand. You've got to. The rules are you've got to stamp your thing.
Because
I said, "Look, apparently the problem is that if I didn't stamp it, that I could, in theory, go backwards and forwards from Bern to this unnamed place that no one in their right mind would go to all day." I said, "Yeah, but all right, but I'm not going to do that, am I?" Clearly. He said, "No, but..."
Did you say I'm never going to go there again?
And the fine, do you know how much... All right, bear in mind the ticket cost 5 francs. Do you know how much I had to pay?
I'm guessing about 80.
It's 100.
100?
20 times the... It's not as if I was trying to go from Zurich to Geneva first class or something. This was a 10-minute maximum train ticket. I don't want to extrapolate from this that all Swiss railway workers have absolutely no discretion and are just jobs worths and whatever. Maybe some of them do. But the moral, the lesson I got from that is that in Switzerland, rules are rules and you've got to stamp your ticket.
A permanent exhibition has opened in Montreux, honouring the work of the legendary rock band Queen. The exhibition covers the band's sessions in the Mountain Studios, where they created most of the tracks for 6 of their most popular albums. Swiss Public TV interviewed band members Brian May and Roger Taylor when they visited the exhibition in the lakeside town, as Julie Hunt reports.
Good Lord, now this is strange.
This was Queen drummer Roger Taylor's reaction as he entered the Montreux exhibition for the first time. He and the other band members wrote musical history here in this room. The band has released a total of 18 number one albums and 18 number one singles, and this is where they fine-tuned many of their hits. It's a kind of magic. The control room of Mountain Studios has been recreated here in Montreux so that visitors can now mix their own Queen songs. Here you can find the band members' own instruments, costumes, and original Queen handwritten song lyrics. For Brian May, it's a blast from the past.
It's very strange, you know, even though you're prepared, it's odd because it is like walking back into a world which we've moved on from. And it affects you more than you think it's going to, I suppose. Yeah, it's like seeing a part of your life replayed. Nice, you know, very nicely done. But for us, it is a kind of emotional journey back.
Out of all the places Queen recorded songs in, why did this small town of Montreux become their second home? Roger Taylor has the answer.
I think really it was being in Montreux and being in Switzerland and with all those nice things. Instead of being in the middle of a large city, you were surrounded by beautiful countryside and beautiful scenery. So. And we liked that, and it enabled us to get on with work, you know, and not be distracted by a big city.
Justin Shirley-Smith worked for many years in Montreux as the band's sound engineer. He has special memories of one particular day in summer 1991, just before Freddie Mercury's death.
Everybody else was away, and Dave Richards, the engineer, was ill, so Freddie said, well, you'll have to record me. So it was just him standing there singing in the control room and me recording him. And that was a very special day because it was one of the last vocals he ever recorded.
And this was how it sounded.
It's winter fall, red skies are clear.
He sang amazingly, even though he was struggling physically. He'd been conserving his energy to try and get the most power out of his voice, which is there on the records. You can hear it on Winter's Tale and Mother Love.
Freddie Mercury died from AIDS-related pneumonia in November 1991, but his memory lives on here in Montreux.
That was Julie Hunt reporting. Visit us at swissinfo.ch to see video footage of the exhibition. That's all we have time for this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Susan Masika. We watch the show.